Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 27th of October. This hour of the program, phenomenal actress and Broadway show star Patti LuPone will be joining us. Patti has a memoir out that is Patti LuPone, a memoir in which she says she has been incredibly fortunate over the course of her long career to have been associated with some extraordinary dramatic and musical productions and also some rather spectacular disasters. Looking back, she can find gifts and life lessons in everyone, and that's what's in the book. She swept the 2008 Theater Awards, including the Tony, Drama Desk, and Outer Critics Circle Awards for Best Actress in a Musical for her performance as Rose in the critically acclaimed Broadway revival of the classic musical Gypsy. She has been in many other shows. Of course, her starring role in Evita made her a star, and we'll hear about Patti LuPone's life and hear some of her music and have a rip-roaring good time this hour on the Ideas Network.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God knows anything goes. Good authors too, who once knew better words, now only use for letter words.
Patti LuPone is our guest this hour. She's with us for the first 45 minutes, and then we'll talk to somebody from the Milwaukee Rep as she has to get to Broadway because she's appearing now in Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. Patti, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Where'd you get that voice? I mean, that's just such a Broadway voice. And you had
Who
it
when... knows?
You
it
had
was
it
there when I was a kid.
I know.
And I became aware of it at a very young age, and knock on wood, it hasn't failed me too many times, but it's, I don't know. I don't know where it comes from.
Yeah, but you had some a woman who nurtured that voice, and we all need somebody like that in our lives. When you were very young, who recognized, ooh, she's good.
Yes, Esther Scott, my music teacher in junior high and high school.
Esther.
Esther Scott, who's still alive, celebrating her 90th birthday, I think on November 27th. I can't go to the party because I'm on stage, but she was one of those teachers that inspired everyone around her, and she took me under her wing. She recognized my talent. She also recognized my desire, and she had a great sense of humor. She was an inspirational teacher. The things that she said to all of us, whether we chose to be in show business or you know, pursue a career in music, were just inspiring and life lessons at that young age.
Mm-hmm. And you knew right off, you were just taken by the whole thing. This is what you wanted to do. Who really cared about science and everything? Eventually, you have to learn everything if you're going to be as successful an actress as you are. But you got the bug pretty early on.
4 years old.
Oh, my gosh, 4 years old.
Yeah. I was tap dancing and fell in love with the audience and never looked back.
You have to tell us this sheep story because it is just hysterical.
Oh, well, we were doing, there was a group of kids. It was the Northport, Long Island public school system, when I was growing up, and I believe to this day, had a very strong music department, equally as strong as the athletic department, which is not the norm in most schools. And especially now, and it breaks my heart, but we were marched into the Ocean Avenue Elementary School at 8 years old and the third grade class and told to pick either a band instrument or an orchestra instrument, and it became an integral part of our education. And so those of us that leaned towards the music department for real performed in the summer in a group called the Patio Players, which was just a kid-run, kid-operation. And we did Gypsy 1 year, and our artistic director, David Babcock, knew we needed a lamb. Well, as everybody knows, lambs are born in the spring, so we went to it was in a state, actually, because it had sheep sort of grazing on a rolling hill, and we borrowed a lamb, but it was actually a sheep. And brought him to the East Northport Junior High School. It was Middleville Junior High School where we were performing. And in dress rehearsal, he was fine. I played Louise, and I sang the song Little Lamb. And the sheep was quite docile in the blue spotlight until opening night, where poor thing, I don't know, got stage fright and started bawling, and I had to let him go. And I was laughing under my breath while I was trying to sing this very tender ballad, and I was afraid the sheep was going to fall into the organ. Because you couldn't see the sheep. All you could hear were his hooves and the baaing. And they finally caught him and put him in the boys' bathroom off the stage, which is tiled. So you just heard the sheep all night long in the boys' room off of the stage.
Oh, I love that story. That is so funny. And when you talk about Gypsy, Gypsy has really woven its way into your life several times in pretty big ways.
Yes, indeed. When I was in junior high school, and then at Ravinia, the Ravinia Festival in Chicago, and then just recently on Broadway.
I'm so glad you wrote. I grew up in Chicago, and I used to go to Ravinia all the time.
Oh, Ravinia is the best.
Isn't it great?
Pardon me?
Yeah, isn't it great?
It is, and I've been there for 3 decades. I went there first with the acting company in 1976 and played the Martin Theater, and then again with the acting company in 1984 and played the Martin Theater, and then starting in 2000, Wells Kaufman brought a small ensemble of players, and we started doing the Sondheim musicals in the Pavilion. And it's an extremely beautiful performing arts venue, summer theater, I guess you could call it. It's not a theater, it's a summer performing arts festival with all sorts of music and dance. And I love it. It's my summer job, and I couldn't be happier. It's a beautiful, beautiful park.
And all of a sudden you're appearing, and tell me how you feel as a performer in front of 10,000 people. And you think of Broadway as being the bright lights, but 10,000 people versus the theater.
Well, I have to say that I sang the national anthem for the New York Rangers when they were 3 down to the Philadelphia Flyers.
Oh, did you?
And that was an 18,000-person stadium. And after that, nothing is possible. They won that night.
Of course they would.
But you know, the other thing is I played the Muni Opera House. And the Muni Opera House in St. Louis is an outdoor theater that seats 11,000. And we were a flop. We only had 7,500. And you don't imagine ever playing to that many people. But there are places, the Hollywood Bowl, for instance, I think is 17,000 people. And you know what? I've always... years ago when I did Les Mis in London, when it was first... When the show was first created, there was a lot of flack about the size of the sets by the critics. And I didn't understand this argument. I live in life, and, you know, buildings are taller than I am. Cars are taller than I am. I'm not going to let that dwarf me. So I didn't understand the complaint that the critics had about the size of our sets. So the same thing applies to the size of the theaters you're playing. I'm trained to reach them. I'm trained to reach out and to the last row. And, you know, that's impossible in an 18,000 seat house, but you have to make the effort. You can't be dwarfed by it. What are you doing on the stage then?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the object is to be larger than life.
Let's talk about the training and the really intense years at the acting company.
That was Juilliard.
And then the acting company. To become a really, really well-trained actor, actress, what you had to go through was really exploring the depths of what being a human being is all about. It was intense, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the Juilliard School. We were the first class of the drama division. The Juilliard is an accredited college, but it's more a conservatory, and it was 13 hours a day training the body,
oof,
the voice, the mind, the soul, you know, every bit of it. And they, I think it's not as intense an environment anymore, but they sort of wanted to break down the psyche of the individual and create the Juilliard actor, and that was pretty intense because as a 18, 19-year-old kid, we didn't know what hit us, actually. And it was heartbreaking. It was grueling. It was the best training I could have gotten as an actor. And we continued that. Our class became John Houseman's The Acting Company, and we plied our craft for 4 years on the road doing classical theater, six plays a season, and touring around the country. And there was, I mean, talk about 18,000 seat arenas. How about playing, you know, the altar of a Baptist church in, you know, Tahlequah, Oklahoma, or playing a theater where the tech directors gave our tech director the wrong information and the set is falling off the stage.
Oh my gosh.
So, you know, those kind of experiences just create a level of armor that and experience it that I can face anything. I can walk into any theater and know how to play it because I've played so many different types of stages. And that people don't train anymore. I think, you know, it's difficult to remain anonymous and hone a craft. Everybody wants instant gratification and stardom, but to maintain, I think, any craft, you have to put in the work.
Mm-hmm.
You have to put in the work at the beginning. If you're a cobbler, if you're a silversmith, it has to be... We have no craftsmen left, and that's all it is. It's a craft.
Yeah. And you met the first love of your life, Kevin Klein, who was a part of that theater group.
Yes. I did indeed. And we had a 7-year relationship.
Oh, that's a long time.
Yeah.
Well, it must have been something to be on the road with all these people. You're living together. You're probably sleeping on the same floor in some dive somewhere.
We actually used to ghost in hotel rooms because, you know, we were paying. We were considered by Actors Equity among the highest paid actors because we were employed 50 out of 52 weeks a year. We didn't make a tremendous amount, but it was steady employment. And so when we were on the road, and of course, these were kids I went to school with, so I was with the same group of people for 8 years, for 50 weeks out of the year, for 8 years. We developed a technique called ghosting, which was somebody would check into a hotel and three of us would pile in, and two people would sleep to a double bed. And it didn't matter if it was, you know, male, female, 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 male, male. We were all friends. We were beyond friends. We were all blood at that point. And I remember once, well, I nibble or Slash in my sleep. I remember hearing Ben Hendricks said, "I'm not getting in bed with Slasher." That's when I got the name Slasher. But it was something that we did just to save money. And, it worked.
Yeah, right. I see your point. We'll come back and talk about and hear a little bit of the role that made you a star. The story behind this is really interesting, how incredibly difficult it is to sing the role of Evita and how it hurt her voice so much and how many people wanted to play this role and how audiences responded in New York, particularly to this fascist, not Patty, but Evita. It's really quite a story. So we'll go into that in just a moment. And welcome your phone calls, too. Patty LuPone is our guest. She is the author of her memoir, Patty LuPone, which has just been released. And she's joining us this morning on the Ideas Network. Here's our phone number if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address here is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Don't cry for me, Argentina. The truth is I never left you. Your distance. Have I said too much? There's nothing more I can think of to say to you. But all you have to do is look at me to know that every word is true.
Patty LuPone singing the role that really made her a star. And it could, I think, Patty, almost be the subject of the whole book because it's there's so much in that in terms of what happened in your life, how you had to train for this, who she was, how you studied for the role, how people responded to her. This one made you a star.
Yes, it did. And it it was bound to make the girl that played it a star. There was so much controversy and hype. It was bound to make whoever played it a star because it was never out of the newspapers. So I went along for the ride, and I actually knew what was going to happen to me, I guess because of all the experience I had before I got the role. I knew that this would be a roller coaster ride, and indeed it was. I think any Andrew Lloyd Webber musical comes with a great deal of hype, a great deal of advance anticipation. This one was a hit in London before it transferred to Broadway, and there was just a lot of dialogue, a lot of dialogue. It was innovative, first and foremost. It was absolutely brilliant staging by Hal Prince, and it was probably one of the first sung through, quotes, musicals. I mean, we associate sung through with opera, not with musicals. And the music was odd. It wasn't the typical American musical melody. It was more like a pop opera. So there was a lot of talk even before they cast Evita. And then, of course, Evita is a controversial figure to this day.
Sure.
She came from the lower classes, rose to dizzying heights, died riddled with cancer at 32, and the Peronists were Nazi sympathizers. And so there were a lot of people upset that she was being glorified on the musical stage.
Mm-hmm.
And then here comes me, having to negotiate those waters and then try to sing that part, which is almost impossible. And I was given 6 shows a week because Elaine Page, who originated the role in London, couldn't do the 8. They found out early on that 8 was just too much. So they implemented the alternate, the Wednesday matinee and the Saturday matinee.
Yes.
So that's all I was offered. And even that 6 was frightening. I didn't have any vocal technique.
You said that Andrew Lloyd Webber must have hated women to write a script that had this.
In this particular case, it just where the score sits is what is called the passaggio for sopranos. And the passaggio is Italian for passage. And, you know, just like a rubber band, there is a weak point in the rubber band when you stretch it. So there's a weak point in the voice when you stretch it from bottom to top. And it sat right in that weakest part.
Oh.
And it was a bitch. It was like, I was afraid. How about scared out of my mind every night I went on stage? It's because it was right in my passaggio. And if I hit the first D, which was 10 minutes into the show, incorrectly, it would affect that night, which would affect the entire week.
Oh, my.
So it was scary, and I could play the part. The part was a cinch. Do you know what I mean? Acting-wise, it was expositional in the first act, then you wrap it up in the second act. It was clear. Mandy and I had enough training and were good enough friends and colleagues to be able to connect the dots. But the singing was, and it didn't stop, because just when you thought you were over the hump, there was Rainbow High, where you at the end of the show, where you're hitting the highest notes.
Mm.
So it was, and there's not many people that can sing it in those keys. Anyway, there's only a handful of women that can sing in those keys,
right,
and give it the power that it needs to portray that character.
Yeah, and you didn't want to admit this for a while, but you had visitations from Evita.
Yes, I did, and I didn't. No, I didn't talk about it because I thought, "Am I losing my mind?" But,
right.
I mean, I believe all of that exists. I believe there's energy. I believe that you know, I don't know what you call it, the other world. I don't know, ghosts. What do you want to call it? Spirits. I believe all of that exists, and she materialized to me 3 times, once on the anniversary of her death, which was the second visitation, once before I opened, which was the first visitation, and once before I closed in the part for good in Australia. And actually not to me, but to a stagehand on the stage who actually had to leave the stage. And I didn't know about this until my dressers told me during a change. Didn't happen to me, it happened to the stagehand, and he didn't return that night. He just left the stage.
Oh.
We as actors, I don't know if all actors are susceptible, but a lot of actors are superstitious, and most a lot of Broadway houses are haunted, and you believe that. You don't go, yeah, well, not me. You believe that for whatever reason, for the history of the building, for the impact a former actor can have on you. I don't know, but we are believers. And when this happened, it scared me to death. And then I relaxed. I thought, even if it's not a visitation, the first one, even if I'm making this up, what it did was relax me. Because basically she said to me, you're not going to stink. I'm not going to let you. It's my name. I'm going on a ride, sister. You are not going to stink.
That's funny.
So, whether it was my mind playing tricks on me or not, it eased a lot of tension. Because
right.
I thought she was watching. I thought she was supporting. I thought she was guiding. And that may sound ridiculous to some people, but it is what it is,
Right.
Whether it's that or something else, it the effect it had allowed me to continue positively in a role that was, at that point, the hardest role I had ever attempted.
Right. I felt that when I read the book. This was something for you to have to go through. Let's go to a phone call. Jeff in Ashland. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. My heart's in my throat right now. I'm actually talking to Patty. Oh my God!
Hi, Jeff.
I heard your soundtrack from Evita many, many years ago, obviously, and wore it out. And because of hearing it, I've fell in love with Broadway and all that stuff that a lot of people do. But I just wanted to say that you put the magic in Broadway, and you are the diva of divas.
Oh, Jeff, thank you.
But I saw the I saw the movie, of course, and was very disappointed and actually disgusted with how the movie cheapened, the magic of Evita and of a Broadway show. And basically just wondered if you saw it and if you had any views. I'm not bashing Madonna. She did the best she could, I think, but it just was not a good movie.
Well, actually, I didn't see it, but I at the gym, when they used to have MTV used to have videos, I saw Buenos Aires, and the first thing I noticed was that they lowered the keys. And I thought, well, it's like if you lowered Mimi's keys, and, you can't mess around with a score like that. The impact is lessened. And then, it looked boring. It looked boring to me. The thing that I don't understand about Hollywood is that they assume that they can do a better job than, if they're going to take a Broadway musical, they assume they can do a better job than how it was created. And I think one would need to address the original production and how Prince is staging. Not that you can translate that onto film, but what was it that made it a success on the stage? And I think they totally ignored that. I remember the very first time I was doing Evita, and I was at a party at Robert Stigwood's, and Paramount had it. And a Paramount ad man said to me they were going to add dialogue, and they were going to split the character of Che into a cab driver and Che. And I went, whoa, stop. Why are you adding dialogue? We erased that controversy right there. It is a sung-through musical. Everybody knows it is. Why are you adding that? They were changing it, and High Flying Adored was going to be in the cockpit of a plane.
Oh, my.
So, I don't know. They've lost it. They've lost that thing, that whoever they are, that can take a Broadway musical and make a movie out of it. I mean, when you look at Carousel and you look at Oklahoma, they did a really good job. You look at West Side Story, they did a really good job
Yes.
of transferring those musicals to film. But they haven't been successful lately, I don't think. Do you? Look at A Chorus Line. Oh, my God. Anyway.
your brother was in A Chorus Line.
My brother was Zach in A Chorus Line, yep.
Yeah, that's great. Here's an email that's come in from Michael. I'm a huge Sweeney Todd fan, and Patty is my absolute favorite. Mrs. Lovett, I love her portrayal of the character, unlike Angela Lansbury, who portrayed her as a rather sweet, unwitting accomplice to Sweeney's devious deeds. Patty played Ms. Lovett as a much stronger woman very much aware of what she's doing, very consciously looking out for her own interests, and in her own way trying to manipulate Sweeney to get what she wants. This person would love to hear you talk about her interpretation of the role and what it was like to work with the legendary George Hearn, his favorite Sweeney, in the San Francisco concert version of Sweeney Todd.
Well, first of all, working with George, always working with George, is sublime. He is a very generous man, a very loving and supportive man, and he is a terrific, brilliant actor. So I am a huge fan of George Hearn. And thank you so much for the very high compliments. I read the script, and that's sort of where it led me. She is. Steve actually said that she is the true villain of the piece because she is the pragmatist. She isn't exactly that. She is looking out for her own welfare and trying to win the love of Sweeney Todd. So she'll do anything to keep him there and, you know, sort of around her, in her environment, whatever. And it's a phenomenal part to play because it has all the elements that an actor wants on a stage. Laughter, tears, you know, drama, Greek tragedy, mm-hmm. getting thrown in an oven, or down, you know, wherever I got thrown. It's a great, great part. And then, of course, it's an extremely difficult part to sing because Steve is very, his melodies are very intricate. So there is the accomplishment. And believe me, I haven't accomplished it. There's one song I have never sung correctly, More Hot Pies, because the melody is so intricate. But, you know, you strive for that achievement, and it's all about the work, and that's a part I would love to play again, love to investigate again, and a part I just love.
Let's talk a little bit about the film world. You've done some films, and I know that you were awaiting. I can't remember, what show were you doing in Hollywood, and you had to wait in the airport? It's a great story.
Oh, I was shooting 1941.
Oh, right.
And I had to fly back to New York for the final callback for Evita and got caught in the 1978 blizzard.
Ooh. And you knew that your name was going to be mud in Hollywood unless you got back there.
The producer of the movie, Treat Williams, was one of the stars, and he wasn't called to shoot on a particular day, and Steven Spielberg changed the shooting schedule, needed Treat, and nobody could find Treat, so the day was sort of wasted. So there was an edict that nobody could leave L.A. till the shoot was over. Well, I didn't have a part. I was a glorified extra, and I got a telephone call to come back to New York for the final callback, and everybody said, well, Buzz said no, and then Steven said go, and then I got caught in the blizzard, but Buzz actually said to me, if you're not back on Tuesday, your career in Hollywood is dead. I thought, oh, wow, I've got a career in Hollywood. Who knew? And I didn't get back. I actually got back because Christopher Reeve, who had made a huge success with Superman, but went to Juilliard, saw me at the airport in tears, in rollers, and I actually got me on the plane.
It was a lovely story.
Yeah, I got back to Hollywood, and they said, how'd you get out? And I told them, Superman.
Superman. Marty from Bennett. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning. Patty, I grew up with a woman who's been on Broadway, and as I age, I'm wondering what kind of roles are there for women of a certain age as you work your way through your career? I see lots of things for, let's even be generous, saying if you're under 40, which is not to assume I know how old you are. That was a big, sorry assumption that I made there, but...
No, it's a legitimate. Are you kidding? It's a legitimate question. I am 61, and I am playing. I'm very fortunate. I don't know why. Maybe it's because I'm small, and I have a lot of energy. But I'm on stage in a part with women from 20 to 40. Somehow they skipped over 50, and I feel very grateful that I can hold. That I am on a stage with women that are in their 20s, in their 30s, and in their 40s. It's women on the verge of a nervous breakdown. And what is after this? I question that too, Marty. There are tons of roles. If producers want to produce them, But as far as musicals, no one ever has written a musical for me, so I'm not sure they're going to start at my age. But I think the advantage of theater is you're kind of ageless on the stage, where you're not in a close-up on film. And I wonder how long I will be hireable. Is that the word? It's a worry. It's a worry. Seems, but actors can act until they drop dead.
Anything else, Marty?
Well, is your voice? Are you concerned about your voice maintaining its strength?
Well, I trained as an actor, so if I can't sing anymore, I can definitely do plays because I know how to act. And I am concerned about my voice, but so far, it's as strong, if not stronger, than it's ever been.
Oh, it's very strong. You can hear it in this interview. Very strong.
Well, thanks. And, you know, it's just, but there is that concern, too. And there's, you know, the health of the voice. Everything's deteriorating. I went to the physical therapist, and he thinks that's the beginning of an arthritic hip. Ay, 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 what happened? Do you know what I mean? So what do? You just do the best you can and hope for the best and hope that everything slows down.
Wait till you start dozing in the afternoon, Patty.
I do.
All right, there you go.
I can't wait for the end of the matinee so I can take my nap. But that's always been the case. I never leave the theater. I always eat my dinner between shows and sleep. That's just what I've done since I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
I never leave the environment. I love it. There I stay.
Thanks.
So, Marty, I hope that the voice holds up like Barbara Cook's has held up, and I hope that I'm singing at 85, 90. And it may not be what I sounded like when I was 20, but the emotion will be behind there, and maybe a little more wisdom,
mm-hmm.
and maybe it'll be moving. And I hope that I'm hired because of my history and not necessarily because I'm an old person.
Right. Yeah. And the history is important. Tell me about your son. Is he in the business?
Oh, my God, yes. He's at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York, in the drama department. And he grew up backstage, so of course he has the bug. And he has charisma. He's very handsome. He's one of the most sensitive and considerate human beings I know. He's got maybe an ounce of my genes and all of my husband's. And I just wish him the best of luck. It's a tough, grueling profession. I don't know who ever said it was glamorous. Well, the theater isn't glamorous. Maybe film is. I don't know. I mean, no, film isn't glamorous either. I've done movies. Everything is a little gritty and takes a lot of hard work.
Well, why are you doing it then?
I love it.
All right.
My passion. I was born to it. It chose me.
It chose you at a very young age.
Yep.
At a very young age. But I want to make sure we get some of these little stories in before we take another phone call and before you have to leave us because you have to go do a show. Lana Turner coming backstage talking about her encounter with Evita Perón. It's quite a story. She came backstage to see you.
She did. She came with her hairdresser, and she came to my dressing room, and I was totally freaked out. There was Lana Turner looking unbelievably spectacular. And she sat with me for an hour, and I thought, oh, she wants to be friends with me. Actually, there were so many paparazzi outside that she stayed in my dressing room until she got the all clear so that they could sneak her out. But while she sat with me knee to knee, holding my hand, she told me a story that there used to be the Pan American Movie Festival that took place in Argentina. And the Hollywood actors would fly down and go to it and then go home. And the Peróns were in power. And she went, and she was about to go home, and her passport had been confiscated, her and her escorts. And, oh, I know what it was. She had received invitations from Evita Perón to come to the Casa Rosada, which she declined a couple of times. Then she was about to leave, and her passport was confiscated. And she was arrested, basically, and taken to the Casa Rosada and made to wait in a hallway until Evita received her. And she thought, you know, she's going to get locked up. She walked the distance, met the queen, and the queen said, I just wanted to tell you I modeled my pompadour hairdo after yours, and let her go.
That's a great story.
Isn't that a wild story?
Yeah, that's wild. That's wild. How about meeting one of my favorite people? We used to interview him all the time, and I really miss him. Studs Terkel. You did Working.
Oh, I love Studs.
Yeah, he was a great guy.
He was a great guy, but, a great humanitarian.
Right, but what happened to that show? It was only, what, 3-week run?
Well, you know, when a flop's a flop, it sure is a flop, and ours was a flop. There's a fine line between a hit and a flop. I don't think that the creators paid enough attention to the book. I think it was overly ambitious, and I think Studs was disrespected, quite frankly.
Really?
And it's a pity, because it could have been a great musical.
Yes.
It had a really wonderful cast, but... And it was always great when Studs came around. Always great. He was such a light.
Isn't he, though?
Yeah.
And the stories and the memory. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Let's go to John. Hi, John in Shorewood.
Hi, Kathleen. I just wanted to thank you and Christy and Rhonda for your wonderful guests. I'm thrilled to be talking to Patty. I'm actually the husband of Michael, who emailed before. I had a question.
Hi, John.
Hi, Patty. You were speaking about movie musicals before, and I wanted to ask about Sweeney Todd movie recently. I guess I was very disappointed, because movie portrayals in the popular consciousness tend to in a way define roles, like Robert Preston and Shirley Jones in The Music Man, for example. And I thought that Sweeney Todd deserved, a Patti LuPone and a George Hearn versus a Helena Bonham Carter and a Johnny Depp. I thought the singing was not good. I'd like to hear your thoughts about the Sweeney Todd movie, if you could.
Well, my first impression was that it seemed like Tim Burton didn't want to make the musical Sweeney Todd. Then he should have just done, what they call them, those penny, I can't remember what the word is, those. He should have just done the play Sweeney Todd. I don't think he allowed them to sing. I think probably they could have torn up the screen if he had given all of them freedom. I was very disappointed in the movie. Very disappointed. It deserved to be sung, and I didn't like the way he had changed the score around. But I'm a traditionalist. Do you know what I mean? I wanted to see Sweeney the score. I wanted to hear the score, and hear it in the order in which it was written. And I wanted to hear, when you hear the overture played by the London Philharmonic, and then you don't hear that in the movie, in the individual songs, it was a big disappointment. It's visually stunning, but I'm with you. I wanted to hear it sung. I really wanted to hear it sung.
You wanted to hear it sung.
Yeah, it's a great score.
Yeah, John. Anything else? We have to go.
Oh no, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. John.
Thank you. And so that now the rest of the day for you. And I know you have to go. You have to go to work, Patty.
I have to go to work.
Okay.
I have two shows.
Oh my gosh. You've got energy, dear. You got energy for 61.
It's really nothing. I mean, it's joyful. It's a
good.
Lot of fun.
Good.
What I do is a lot of fun.
Good.
It's hard work, but ultimately, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I get you. Thank you so much for the book. It was a great read, and thanks for all the performances.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Sure, our pleasure. Patti LuPone, our guest, and her book is Patti LuPone, A Memoir, which has just been released, and I know she's got a lot of fans in this area. Patti LuPone, our guest here on the Ideas Network, and we thought we would play just a little bit more of her because she's got a voice.
He slept a summer by my side. He filled my days with endless wonder. He took my childhood in his stride, but he was gone when autumn came.
Patti LuPone from the 1985 London production of Les Miserables. We are going to continue talking theater, and we will soon be joined by Sandy Ernst, Associate Artistic Director of the Milwaukee Repertory Theater, in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We wanted to continue our conversation about theater and live stage shows, which I think just can't be beat. Sandy Ernst is our guest from the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. I saw an absolutely phenomenal cabaret, which I think just ended at the Rep, although I may be wrong about that. We'll find out from Sandy. But the Rep has done wonderful theater for years and years and years. Sandy Ernst is in her 16th season with the Milwaukee Rep, doing casting and assisting with season planning. She's been married to Lee Ernst, who was the MC in Cabaret and did a marvelous performance. Before moving to Milwaukee, Sandy spent 18 years with the equally fantastic American Players Theater in Spring Green, where she directed 20 productions and stage managed over 50 productions. Sandy, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, a great pleasure. So is Cabaret over yet, or is it still?
It is.
Oh, darn.
It closed. We were very sad to say goodbye to some marvelous people on, hopefully not forever, on Sunday night. And we are very, very proud of that production. I don't know that any of us here really knew how we were going to get our arms around it, and it was a fabulous production.
It was a fabulous production. It was so good, and the word of mouth spread on that so that everybody said, you got to see this because it's so good. It was spreading all over town.
Wonderful. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. So, Sandy, you have a lot to do with season planning. Tell me how you decide what's coming up in a year. I mean, how do you choose a show like Cabaret, which was something different for the Rep?
Oh, it was. Well, you know, we're in a little bit of a learning curve now with Mark Clemens coming on board as our new artistic director. And I was delighted when he started talking about doing our first main stage musical. And it just seemed like a brilliant way to start his tenure, him directing a really iconic, wonderful musical in that space and incorporating some of our resident company and some wonderful local people. And it's a genre we haven't done in that space before, and I thought that he was really brilliant in how to incorporate all those people and the music and the dance with wonderful Michael Pink from the Milwaukee Ballet and an orchestra that was made up of, you know, Kit Kat club dancers as well as our wonderful intern company, and managed to put it all on that space and make it work.
Yeah, it was so good.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at a season, are you looking at that which hasn't been done before? Does that guide your decision at all?
You know, it's one of the factors. We're a real repertory theater, always have been. We have three spaces, the Quadracci Powerhouse and the Stimke Studio Theater and the Stackner Cabaret space. And the hope is that within those spaces, and of course Christmas Carol and the Pabst, mm-hmm. that we give our subscribers and audience members really a little bit of everything. So it is American classics like Death of a Salesman that we're doing this year. It is a wonderful place that chances are they have never seen in this country, like Bombshells, which we started rehearsal for yesterday, and this will be the American premiere. Laurel and Hardy, which is a wonderful little show about Laurel and Hardy that's in the Stackner Cabaret and playing now through November 14th, is also an American premiere. And then we also try to give shows that are kind of fresh out of the gates and available to repertory theaters, like Alfred Hitchcock's The 39 Steps, which we'll also be doing in the Quadracci Powerhouse in January and February. So really, it's a little bit of everything. It goes into, you know, we don't want to be, we are not a classical theater. We are not a new works only theater. We're a true repertory theater. So really try to incorporate that.
We just finished an interview with Patti LuPone talking at some point about her early years in the theater, and she said the bug struck her when she was 4 years old. She was performing at the age of four. When did the bug strike you? Because it is a bug. There's a radio bug, I think, too, but there is definitely a theater bug.
You know, I think you're right there. I think there is a theater bug, and I have one of our four children went into theater professionally, and I would say definitely by four, Ben had decided that's what he wanted. I will say I'm an exception to that rule, and really I credit primarily my husband Lee and certainly Randall Duke Kim and Annie Oke Grosso. Mm-hmm. Started American Players Theater because I didn't enter theater really until with just a couple of tiny things in school until American Players Theater.
Really? Isn't that something? Wow.
So 1980 and came to Spring Green, Wisconsin. And, you know, we all had to do everything in the early years there and pretty before I knew it, I was doing a lot.
Yeah. Oh, those productions. I did a lot of interviews when that all started with Randall and the founding members, and probably you at some point. And it was just
a long time ago.
Long time ago. It was just extraordinary what was happening there. It was. I don't even know what words to use, but it was captivating. The performances were beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So you have four children, and just one went into theater
so far.
Some of them might be like you, huh?
We'll see.
Showing up in some part of the country and taking it up. Okay, so we have, and tell me, take the season out a little bit. What else is going to be happening this year?
Oh, well, we are extraordinarily excited about the two that started rehearsal yesterday. Brent Hazelton, who is the artistic associate at the Rep, wrote and is directing a play called Liberace, and that will the next show up in the Stackner Cabaret. Of course, Liberace was from Milwaukee, and most of the things when we thought about doing a play about Liberace, a lot of them were send-ups or didn't really give his life and music in a way that we thought we wanted to do. So we're doing our own, and Jack Forbes Wilson, who is
Milwaukee,
will be playing him.
Jack is? Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
That was my son's piano teacher.
We're very excited. That one will open on November 19th.
Oh, exciting. Oh, great.
And so I hope everybody gets in to see that one.
Yes.
And we also started rehearsals yesterday. Another play that Mark is directing called Bombshells. A one-woman show with the fabulous Caroline O'Connor, who is a household name in Australia, in England. Not so much in this country yet, but maybe we'll change that. She's probably best known to a lot of American audiences. She made her Broadway debut as Velma in Chicago in 2002, but she was in the movie Moulin Rouge, played Ninny Legs in the Air, probably remembered from that kind of powerful tango number. And she also played Ethel Merman in De Lovely, that 2004 musical portrait of Cole Porter. And in the film soundtrack, she's actually the one singing Anything Goes. She's fantastic actress, singer, dancer, real what we call triple threat. And this play was actually written for her by Australian playwright Joanna Murray Smith. And Bombshells, referring to the bombshells that happen in women's lives, not women who are bombshells, but those bombshells that land in women's lives, you know, getting married, becoming a mother.
Right, all those things. Right.
And it's we're so excited to have her here.
Oh, this is great.
Yeah.
All right.
Mark Clemens said it's just been his ambition to direct her since he first saw her in action, and we're in for a real treat in Milwaukee to have her here. She's
fabulous. Wonderful. Sandy, we're all going to go get our tickets. You're great. Yeah, we're ready to see all of these. They sound fabulous. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Anytime.
Okay, Sandy. Sandy Ernst is Associate Artistic Director at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. They're just off a spectacular run of Cabaret and great productions coming up. Well, that was a fun hour, wasn't it? Makes me want to be a Broadway star again. Our thanks to Sandy and also to Patti LuPone for being with us. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing a very, very fun hour. And thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. I have a furlough day. You know, we got these furlough days, so I won't be with you tomorrow, but I'll be with you again on Monday, the day before the midterms, and we'll be looking at those. And I want to remind you, because this trip is filling up, which I didn't think it would happen this rapidly, but we're going to Washington, D.C. and Gettysburg. Ooh, we're going to have fun March 30th through April 5. We're taking a bus. It's very well organized. It's going to be informative and meaningful. Call Progressive Travel if you are interested in this, 800-231-4391. Okay? Okay. Thank you for listening.